Another fallacy or misstep in doing word studies is the fourth one is sort of the opposite of number one. The first one we discussed was what is often known as an etymological or root fallacy, where the origins or the history of a word is given too much weight in determining what a word means at a certain time. The opposite is to go the other direction and is what is often called anachronism or semantic anachronism. That is reading a Greek or Hebrew word in light of a later meaning. Now, once again, this is not to say that understanding modern Greek and Hebrew, modern Hebrew meanings, don't help at all or have no influence at all on what or might not shed some light on what a word might have meant in its original context. But again, to assume that a later meaning of a Greek or Hebrew word is necessarily what it meant in its original context is certainly a fallacy. And instead, again, what is as important is what that word meant at a given time in history for our purposes in biblical Hebrew or a first century Koine Greek. For the average student, though, perhaps more difficult, or what they might be more prone to do that do not have access to the original languages, is to perhaps read Hebrew and English, the meaning of Hebrew and English Greek words in light of later English translations, for example. So when we translate Greek and Hebrew words, to think necessarily that the way we have translated it, the meaning of that word in our modern day English, can be read back anachronistically into the ancient text. Or furthermore, the fact that many of our modern day, for example, English words are derivatives from Semitic or even Greek words, such as anthropology is based on the Greek word anthropos, or we talk about pneumatic tools, tools that are run by air, from the Greek word pneuma, that could mean air or wind or breath or spirit. So many of our words, sometimes in English, are derivative of ancient roots in Greek or sometimes other languages. So sometimes a danger is not only to read ancient words in terms of the English words that we've translated them with, but also to interpret a word in a Greek or English word in terms of our modern day derivations of those words. For example, one really easy example, again, that I've culled from a couple of other sources that have recognized this, and not only have I read examples, but I've also heard this committed in pulpits, one of the more well-known ones, it's actually quite silly example, is the example from 2 Corinthians and Paul's discussion of and his instructions to the Corinthians regarding their giving. And in chapter 8 and verse 9, I think, is the one I want. Though that might not be it. The text where Paul tells the Corinthians and instructs them to give because God loves a cheerful giver. And perhaps some of you have heard this. The word cheerful is the Greek word hilarion, from which we get the English word hilarious. And I've seen others point to this, but I've heard examples of preachers who would say, therefore, what God really wants is a hilarious, or a giving to the extent that we laugh and we're ecstatic. The problem is, that's reading the word hilarion in Greek anachronistically in light of our English word hilarious, which is now means something very different from how Paul was using the term. So beware of reading later meanings of words back into the original Greek and Hebrew word meanings. Again, especially for most of us, for most of you English, that especially if you don't know Greek or Hebrew, the danger of reading a Greek or Hebrew text in light of, or Hebrew word, in light of the English word we use to translate it,
thinking that what the word means in English is what it would have meant in Greek, or when certain English words are derivative of early words, and thinking then that our English word again approximates what it meant, what the Greek or Hebrew word meant in its original context. I've already given you an example of a student that in a class I took that misunderstood or could not understand why Paul would use the word hope, or the word that we translate hope, why he would call our salvation, and especially our future salvation, a hope. Could not understand that, based primarily on what the student was doing is confusing the Greek word that we translate hope with what we usually mean by hope when we use it in English. Usually we use the word hope as something that we wish will happen, but we aren't certain whether it will or not. Whereas the Greek word that is usually translated hope is at least in Pauline text, frequently refers to something that is a certainty that one can stake one's life upon. So kind of the opposite of number one, reading later or earlier meanings into the Greek or Hebrew text, the opposite is reading later meanings back into the text. Again, the meaning of the word in its context at that point in time must be determinative. A fifth fallacy, or at least a fifth thing to avoid, is what I call not reinventing the wheel. That is to recognize that much hard work has been done in lexical analysis, and that does not mean that there's not still a lot of work to be done. There is. We're uncovering new material or learning new methodologies and new ways of studying words, so there's a lot, much to be done, and certainly it would be wrong to conclude that the final word has been said. Yet at the same time, when much work has already been done and conclusions are fairly firm, is I'm a big one on not expending energy by doing something that's already been done. And I'd rather use my energy on other areas perhaps that haven't been done. So just be aware of not reinventing the wheel, and simply rehashing and reproducing work that's already been completed. And finally, number six, don't become obsessed with words. That is, as we've already said, words combine to make clauses, and clauses combine to make sentences. Sentences combine into paragraphs, and paragraphs combine into entire discourses. So don't become so obsessed with words. But realize that words are not the ultimate bearers of meaning or carriers of meaning. So don't focus on words to the detriment of other methods. Now, having discussed briefly issues related to how we understand words, what they are, what they do, and understanding a common methodology for approaching them and some of the fallacies to avoid, let me give you just one example of how that might work from Galatians chapter 5, the well-known flesh versus spirit text, where Paul contrasts the deeds of the flesh and the fruit of the spirit. And I want to focus in on that word flesh in Galatians chapter 5, which is the Greek word sarx. But the word sarx, English translators in Galatians 5 frequently translate it with the English word flesh. But this word could be chosen for a couple of reasons. Again, the first step is to choose the word. I've chosen this word for a couple of reasons. Number one, it appears to play a significant role in this context in comparison to the spirit, the word spirit. But also, English translations differ in the way they translate it. Some English translations use the single word equivalent in English, flesh. Other translations, such as the original NIV, translated it sin nature. There's a possibility of misunderstanding this term. If I translate it with the word flesh in English, should that lead me to the conclusion that Paul is talking about the physical flesh or the physical body as somehow complicit in or in sin, or the body itself as sinful or evil? So the word flesh here in Galatians 5 would seem to provide a fruitful term for study. Second, as far as the field of meaning, what could this term possibly mean? How was it used, particularly in the New Testament and in first century Greek? If you consult a couple of the tools that I mentioned earlier and other New Testament lexical type tools, you'll see that the word could have a broad, fairly broad range of meaning and some different meanings and functions. For example, the word flesh, as it does in English, could refer to the physical flesh, so the fleshly part of the body that covers the bones, or it could be used in reference to the entire body. Paul, a couple of places, uses an idiom such as flesh and blood, referring to the entire physical being, the entire body, one's physical existence. So it could refer to the entire body, physical existence. It's used in a couple places when Paul refers to my own flesh, referring to his ancestors, his relations, so physical relations. But it also could be used, a fourth possibility is sometimes you see it used as humanity in opposition or rebellion against God, or humanity as susceptible to sin and as opposed to God, which is more of a spiritual, more of a almost metaphorical usage of a term that's usually used to refer to physical, actually physical flesh. Now, obviously, the first thing to note is it can't mean all of these. That is, when Paul uses the word flesh in Galatians 5, or sarx, the word we translate flesh, it probably does not mean all of these at the same time. So the context most likely will disambiguate meaning, that is, point to one of these meanings as the appropriate one in the context. Notice also the contrast with the Spirit. This would suggest that Paul is not primarily, especially if Spirit means Holy Spirit, the contrast is not primarily between physical versus spiritual, but that Paul probably has something in mind. In other words, he's not against the physical flesh. He's not anti-flesh or against the physical body, and sees the physical body as somehow evil or sinful in and of itself. Instead, better is to understand, let me go back to the, as an example then, the NIV, the original NIV, translating it as sin nature. Interestingly, the 2011 NIV has reverted back to the single word flesh. But the original NIV translated sarx in Galatians 5. Again, not everywhere, but in Galatians 5, in contrast with Holy Spirit, the Spirit, walking in the Spirit, they translated flesh as sin nature. However, to many, this might inappropriately suggest that the sin nature is some ontological part of my being, or some separate impulse, or some separate part of me that produces sin, or something like that. And perhaps because of potential misunderstanding of sin nature, or some that were unsatisfied with that definition, the 2011 version of the NIV has switched to use the word flesh. A better, I think, understanding of the word, when you look at it in its context and relying on some other tools for help, is that here the term flesh, that we translate flesh in English, refers to my entire self, my entire physical, spiritual makeup, my entire self, as weak and susceptible to sin. It refers to my entire self as under the influence of this present evil age and relying on the resources of the present age. So to rely on the flesh, then, in this sense, to rely on the flesh, that is who I am, my entire physical and spiritual being, as belonging to and under the influence of and relying solely on the resources of this present evil age, my entire self is susceptible and weak and susceptible to sin, then is what produces the vices listed in Galatians 5. So probably something along that line is what Paul is asking the readers to avoid when he says the deeds of the flesh are these. That is the when I rely upon my the resources of this present evil age, when I rely on myself as part of this present age, susceptible to sin and weakened towards sin, then inevitably I will produce the deeds of the flesh. However, he asks them to walk in the Spirit, in the new covenant Holy Spirit, and to produce the fruits of the Spirit. So, word studies are important. It's important to understand the meaning of key words and key lexical features in a biblical text, while keeping in mind the different dangers and fallacies that could be committed and to avoid them. And also, again, ultimately to realize that words are not the ultimate bearer or carrier of meaning. But again, words combine to make clauses and clauses sentences and sentences paragraph, and paragraphs come together to produce entire discourse. And so if one only does word studies, you've only dealt with part of how a text communicates meaning. Which then leads us to the next thing to consider in interpretation and hermeneutics, and that is the issue of grammar and context. And so I want to make a series of observations related to how do we analyze the grammar of a text, how do we analyze the broader context. Again, I'm basically directing this at those who do not know Hebrew and Greek. Those who are Greekless or Hebrewless. Obviously, if you know Greek and Hebrew, you have access to a lot more resources and are able to go in a lot more depth than I will discuss here. But beyond just understanding the meaning of words, there's a need to understand then how words are put together to form phrases and clauses and sentences, how those are put together to form paragraphs, how paragraphs then relate to each other and are put together to form entire books or documents or discourses. And what I want to do is focus just a moment on grammatical analysis and make some observations, both in how you might employ grammar in a limited way in trying to understand a text, especially with only access to an English translation, but also how you can evaluate other tools that do discuss the grammar of text. First of all, when it comes to grammatical analysis, that is, I'm using the word grammar fairly loosely, but looking at how words are combined into sentences, how sentences and clauses get combined, again, looking kind of at the grammar of a passage and how it works. Here, probably a more formally equivalent translation is of help. Even a formal equivalent, that is a more literal translation, will not capture completely and perfectly the grammar of the Hebrew or Greek text, but it'll hopefully bring you closer to it than other types, especially more dynamic equivalent types. So if one wants to do a grammatical study, it would help to have at least one or more formally equivalent or literal translations at one's disposal. If you don't know Hebrew or Greek. Also, commentaries can be of great help in alerting you to grammatical issues and how those might be significant for interpretation. Let me just give you a couple of guidelines. And again, due to my area of interest and focus, I'll focus on the Greek language and grammar and how that might influence the way one interprets a text, especially by means of evaluating tools that might make grammatical observations. One important thing to recognize is the difference, at least in both Hebrew and Greek, the difference between the tense system of those languages and, for example, the language of the New Testament. Modern-day spoken English, the translations of the Greek and Hebrew text. Especially with the New Testament Greek, what you will find is the English verb system is primarily, though not exclusively, but primarily temporally oriented. That is, when we think of tense, we think of the English verbs indicating past, present, and future. with both Hebrew and perhaps, and especially Greek, the time of the action, past, present, and future, was not necessarily indicated by the tenses themselves, but would have been indicated by other things in the context. Instead, especially with the Greek tense system, what was indicated is what scholars call aspect, or how the author chose to look at the action, how the author chose to view the action, irrespective of when the action took place or even how objectively it actually occurred. The Greek verb tenses would simply tell us, how did the author choose to view it? How did the author choose to look at this action? And I just want to make a couple comments on two of the main tenses in Greek. One of them is what is called the aorist tense. You'll see commentaries and other works describing the aorist tense. The other is what is known as the present tense. And the genius of these two tenses has often been described with an analogy that, again, this is not new to me. I'm borrowing it from a couple of others. But one could compare aspect in Greek tenses, that is, how the author wants to look at the action, with the analogy of a parade. That is, if I am in a blimp or a helicopter, and let's say there's a parade that takes place, I'll use another American example. If there's a parade that takes place on July 4th to celebrate Independence Day, and that parade begins at 9 o'clock and it ends at 12 o'clock. And I want to make it clear, I'm referring to the same parade with these. What I'm about to say. If I am a news correspondent flying above that parade in a helicopter, I see the parade in its entirety. I don't see it necessarily as it develops and unfolds. I'm not interested in how long it took or how it developed or the different parts. I just see the whole thing. From beginning and end, I see the parade in its entirety. However, taking that same parade, if I am an observer on the street corner, I could see the same parade from a completely different perspective, a completely different aspect. I look at it as it develops and unfolds. I can stand right in the street corner and see the different bands and the different floats moving before me. Again, it's the same parade, but whether I'm looking at it as a whole from a helicopter or whether I'm an observer on the street corner, seeing it develop and unfold, seeing its details, those are simply different ways of looking at the exact same parade. The same is true with New Testament Greek. The aorist tense could look at an action as a whole, as if the author stands back and just sees the whole event, whether it was a real brief event and happened instantaneously, whether it was repeated, whether it took place over a long period of time. The aorist tense would be as if the author stands back and looks at the action as a whole. The present tense would be as if the author decides to enter the action and see it internally as it develops and unfolds in front of him. That would be similar to the present tense. Again, whether the action was short or long or repeated, that could only be determined by the context. All the present tense said was the author looked at the action as from its details, how it developed and unfolded. As opposed to the aorist, it just said, there it is, and looked at it in its entirety. Often the aorist tense in Greek is considered kind of the default tense. That is, again, if you turn on your computer and you start to type in your word processing program, there's usually a default size of font, often 12. And that will automatically come up unless you want to click and choose a different size font, an 8 or a 10 or something like that. Again, your computer will have a default printer. That is the printer that it automatically chooses. You will select it, and that's the default printer. Unless you want to choose something else, that's the one that will come up. The aorist tense in Greek, that again you can find referred to in textbooks and commentaries, the aorist tense was the default tense. That is the tense the author would use unless he had some reason to use something else. What that means is that, and how this perspective on Greek determines the way that we analyze the language. And again, if you're a non-Greek reader or non-Hebrew reader, you are reliant mainly on commentaries and other tools to help you. But how this helps us, I think, to avoid misunderstanding of Greek tenses. For example, you still find this often, although we're starting to learn to avoid it, but you'll still often find things in commentaries or other, especially more popular Bible study tools, you'll see things like the aorist tense is used to indicate that the action was once and for all, or it was instantaneous, or it was urgent, it was final. You'll see things like that. However, again, if the aorist tense is the default tense that just looks at the action as a whole, probably we shouldn't, as students, we shouldn't make anything of the aorist tense. We can probably safely move on from it. And we should avoid commentaries that put a lot of stock in the aorist and make those kinds of statements about the aorist, that it was instantaneous or once for all, or it indicated some special type of action. Actually, the opposite is true. Again, the aorist tense was the tense used when the writer didn't want to say anything specific about the action. It was the default tense. So be aware of yourself making too much out of the aorist tense, but be aware of commentaries and other tools that might make too much out of the aorist tense. The present tense also. The present tense you'll often see described in commentaries and other tools, even popular biblical studies tools. You often find the present tense is described as, the present tense is used when the action is continuous or habitual or ongoing over a period of time. However, again, the present tense is used simply when the author wants to look at the action as developing and unfolding, no matter how long or how short the action actually transpired. And again, I've done some work with the present tense, and I found that sometimes the present tense is used of very short actions, sometimes it's used of very long actions. You can't tell except from the context. All the present tense does is say the author, it's as if he enters the action to kind of see its makeup, how it develops. It's kind of a close-up look, a more close-up perspective on the action than the aorist tense is. So what that means, for example, is that sometimes the author might use the present tense to simply draw attention to an action, in contrast to the default aorist that just summarizes it. An author might use a present tense to focus on, to focus more specifically or draw more attention to. So what that means is you need to avoid comments on your own, or beware of comments and commentaries and other tools that say the author used a present tense, so it means continuous action, or ongoing action, or durative action, or habitual action, or something like that. The present tense itself does not indicate that. Whether an action is ongoing or habitual, you can only tell from the context, or continuous, or something like that. So be aware of using the present tense to draw illegitimate conclusions, especially be aware of commentaries and other tools that place a lot of stock in the present tense, meaning the action is continuous and ongoing or something like that. Again, often in comparison to the aorist tense, the present will function when the author simply wants to take a more close-up action, wants to perhaps focus in a little more detail on an action than he would if he used an aorist tense. Another example that you'll find in grammars to be aware of, just to give you one other, is conditional statements. You're aware of, you frequently use or read conditional statements. It's an if-then statement. If this, then this. So if I say, if the student studies Greek diligently, then she will receive an A. The main part of the sentence, she will receive an A, is conditioned upon the first part, if the student studies Greek diligently. So the fulfillment of the action, she will receive an A, is conditioned upon or dependent on the if part, if that person studies diligently. Greek has a construction known as a first-class condition construction, and you often find commentaries and other tools say that when there is a first-class condition, you'll see that language, first-class condition, you should translate it since. That is, the if part actually means it's actually happening. It's since. So since you are studying Greek, you will receive an A. So you often find commentaries and other tools of locating first-class condition sentences in Greek and therefore drawing the conclusion, this is really happening. It should be translated, not if, that's not strong enough, but you should translate it since. The problem with that is there are just too many instances where that isn't the case in the New Testament. And so, for example, Matthew chapter 12, verse 27, I think it is. In Matthew chapter 12, Jesus is in conflict with the Pharisees who have accused him of casting out demons in the name of Satan. And Jesus responds by saying, if I cast out demons in the name of Satan or Beelzebub, then by whose authority do you cast them out? That's a first-class sentence. If Jesus says, if I, Jesus, cast out demons, that's a first-class sentence. Should we translate that since? Is Jesus saying, yes, since I am casting out demons? There's all kinds of examples like that, so just beware of commentaries that place a lot of weight on first-class conditions and say it should be translated since. The point of all this, in a sense, is to recognize Greek is a language like any other language, and it's illegitimate to inject too much precision into it, to expect to make it do too much, to expect too much out of it. It was a completely adequate means of God's communication of his revelation to his people in the first century. But at the same time, it's certainly illegitimate to treat it in a way that is unnatural. So my point is just be aware in your own analysis, but be aware especially as you read commentaries and other tools, be aware of those that would demand too much precision of the language or make it do things that it's really not meant to do, and it would place too much stock in little grammatical nuances. But again, you'll have to use commentaries and other tools if you're Greekless or Hebrewless, which is fine, but you'll have to use other tools to help you make grammatical observations, but be aware of those that overanalyze the grammar. One example that we've already looked at, actually, but one example that might help with understanding how grammar can make a difference. And we talked about this in relationship to translation, but the translation issue in this text is actually a grammatical one. And that is that section in Ephesians chapter 5. And in Ephesians chapter 5, in verse 18, we find a well-known imperative to not be drunk with wine, but to be filled by the Spirit. If you have a rather literal wooden translation, you'll see that what follows in English translation is a series of participles. At least in English, they're often translated with a form of the verb with ing on the end. So you'll see a series of participles after verse 18. So he says, don't get drunk with wine, which is debauchery or leads to debauchery, but instead be filled with the Spirit, literally speaking to one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, singing and making music in your hearts of the Lord, giving thanks to God the Father for everything. And all those participles, singing, speaking, giving thanks, they all go back and modify the command to be filled with the Spirit. And I think they simply explain and describe what does that mean, what does that look like. Interestingly, though, and again, this is where English translations differ, is what do we do with verse 21, which most English translations seem to translate as a separate verse, and some of them even begin a new paragraph. But actually, verse 21, submitting to one another, verse 21, that verb submit, is another participle in this string of participles. It probably goes back to the command, be filled with the Spirit. So a better way to read this text then would be, don't get drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit, which means speaking to one another in psalms, hymns, spiritual song, singing and making music to the Lord, always giving thanks to God the Father for everything, and submitting to one another. So submitting to one another is part of what it means to be filled with the Spirit. So grammatically, what you do with that verse And even comparing English translations might make a difference in the way you interpret this text. Another thing to pay attention to, especially in English translation, with English translations, this can even be done, but it's at times a little more accurate to do it with the Greek text, and that is to pay attention to connectors, such as the buts and ands and therefores, and whenever, or because, or for, those words that function to connection to connect words, or even clauses, or even sentences, or even sometimes paragraphs. So it's important to understand the force of connectors. Again, the therefores and the buts and the because of this or something like that. Try to determine what that says about the relationship of the words or paragraphs or sentences to each other. That's part of helping to trace the flow of thought through the passage. To consider different literary types, this is probably more significant, particularly in epistolary literature, that often depends on a tightly knit argument that moves from line to line or verse to verse or whatever. Again, with narrative literature, we're mainly interested in the connection between paragraphs and how the story develops. So sometimes the detailed grammar of the verses themselves and sentences is not as important as what's going on at the story and the paragraph level. The other thing, though, with connectors, and this isn't the only way to identify relationships between sentences, sometimes you still have to identify what's the relationship between this verse and the one that comes before it or the one that comes after it, or what's the relationship of this paragraph to the previous one. But even with connectors, even when you have the help of connectors, like a therefore or a but or because or in order that or something like that, even then, sometimes it's difficult to tell what are they connecting. Are they simply connecting two words? Are they connecting sentences? Are they connecting paragraphs? So all I'm saying is you need to work with the text and try to figure out the function of each section. What is this sentence doing here? What is this verse doing here? How does it work in the entire paragraph? A good example is that's even, I think, revealed in the English translation. In an English translation is Romans chapter 5 and verse 12. This is a section that begins a comparison that Paul makes between Christ and Adam, where he compares and contrasts what the act of Adam in sinning, what that did to the human race, which now is corrected and reversed in the one act of Jesus Christ, the act of Christ, obedience of Christ, that is his death on the cross. This comparison and contrast between Adam and Christ is introduced by an interesting construction that most English translations simply say, therefore. So I'm looking at the NIV version. It says, therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man. Other translations might be a little more wooden and literal and translate it closer to the Greek text, which is because of this. Literally, because of this, just as sin entered into the world. And he goes on to the comparison. The question is, what is the because of this indicating? Well, obviously, it's showing that something has happened previously that is a cause for this comparison between Adam and Christ. Something Paul has just said is a cause. Because of this, because of something he's just said, now he launches into comparison between Adam and Christ. But the debate is, what is Paul referring to? Because of this, because of what? Is Paul referring back, for example, to the previous verse in chapter 11 verse 11 of Romans 5, Paul ends by saying, not only is this so, but we also now rejoice in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have now received reconciliation. So is it because of that statement? Or is the because of this, or the therefore, does it refer back to chapter 5, 1 through 11? Does it refer back to the entire first 11 verses of chapter 5? Or does it go back earlier? Perhaps it goes all the way back to chapter 3, verse 21, where Paul begins explicitly to discuss justification by faith. Or does it go all the way back to chapter 1 and verse 18? Which is kind of the beginning of the body of the letter to the Romans. So, you know, sometimes it's going to be difficult to tell exactly, you know, what do some of the, when I see a therefore or because of or for or whenever or consequently or a word such as that is it's sometimes going to be difficult to know, well, what's it connecting back to? How far should I go back? That's all part of hermeneutics and interpretation and trying to put the text together to make sense of it, wrestling with the grammar, with the connection of clauses and words and paragraphs and things like that. To move on from grammar and to discuss briefly to kind of broaden out from just words to looking at how words are combined into sentences and paragraphs, to broaden out and look at the entire literary context. So more broadly, you need to ask the question and look at how does my passage fit within the broader context or literary flow of the entire book? Or more specifically, if I am dealing with a text in the Old or New Testament, how does it relate to what comes before it? How does it grow out of it? How does it prepare for or relate to what comes after it? You need to be able to explain how your text fits within the context. A very simple illustration of how this is important and how it's ridiculous even in our own day to ignore this is none of us goes to a movie store or to a Red Box or something like that and we check out a movie we've never seen. And we take it home and pop it into our DVD player. And then perhaps we, when the scene selection, the menu scene selection comes up, and we choose scene 17. And then maybe when we get to scene 17, we fast forward into the middle of it, and then we watch 10 minutes of it. I would expect that you would be left confused and having no idea what in the world's going on. You want to know how the entire story develops. You want to know how the plot or how the argument unfolds and develops so that you can understand any given section in the movie. The same is true with a biblical text. I think one of the most important things that you can do in hermeneutics or interpreting a biblical text is to, and one of the most valuable aspects, is to be able to explain how your text contributes to the argument that's going on. To explain how your text fits where it is. What's it doing there? What would be missing if it weren't there? What does it contribute to the argument? How does it fit with or grow out of the previous section? How does it prepare for what comes after it? And again, there can be a variety of types of relationships, often depending on too, whether you're dealing with narrative literature or whether you're dealing with epistolary literature. There can be a number of types of relationships between the paragraphs and the broader context, the broader sections of the text. There might be more of a chronological relationship. You'll find this particularly in narrative, though we said even in narrative things aren't always arranged chronologically, but certain events might be arranged according to chronology. At times, certain sections might explain something that comes before. Your text might be an illustration that comes of something that has come before it. Your text might be the cause of something that comes before it or after it. There might be a cause and effect relationship. It might be a question-answer relationship. Your text might be answering a question that was raised in an earlier text. Your text might be arranged according to the particular or general. That is, your text might give the particulars of a general statement or might be a general summary of what some particular examples. So there's all kinds of possible relationships, comparison and contrast. Your text might be a contrast or comparison to something that's come before or after. So just be alert to a number of possibilities of how, and more important than these labels is simply being able to explain what is your text doing there in its context. How does it grow out of what comes before? How does it relate to and emerge and merge into what comes after it? And again, at times, this can be the most important, I think, facet of interpreting biblical text. And sometimes we will misunderstand a text, or at least not understand it clearly until we understand how it fits within the broader context. A very simple example that many others have pointed to as well, but it's an easy one and kind of an easy entry point into thinking about context, is the example from Philippians chapter 4 and verse 13, that as I have, you've probably heard quoted in a variety of different ways. And chapter 4, verse 13, Paul says, I can do everything through him who gives me strength, depending on your translation. And so we take this text and we utilize it for justification for various things. I can take an exam that seems to be looming large and is too difficult and I don't feel prepared for, because I can do everything through Christ who strengthens me. I can get along with difficult family members or relatives or friends because I can do all things through Christ. So usually this is applied to areas in our lives, a variety of areas that we find difficult, but we can rely on Christ's strength to help us to overcome these obstacles or accomplish these tasks that appear possible. And I don't want to deny that that's indeed true, but I want to ask, what does this verse, how does Paul seem to be using it? How does it contribute to the argument? How does it relate to what comes before it, particularly, and after it? Notice chapter 4, verse 13, if you back up, and I'll start with verse 10, Paul says, I rejoice greatly in the Lord that at least you have renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you have been concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. I am not saying this because I am in need. So he's responding to the concern of the Philippians. And he says, I'm saying this not because I have need, not because I want you to give me something. And he says, for I have learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is like to be in need. I know what it is like to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. Here's the secret of being content in every situation, whether you're hungry and in need and struggling to get by, or whether you have much. It's, I can do everything through Christ who strengthens me. Chapter 4, verse 13 is referring to Paul's ability, Christ enabling him to be content in any circumstance, whether he has abundance or whether he's struggling to survive and eke out an existence. So sometimes your ability to place a text in its context will have a profound effect on how you understand the text and even help to avoid misunderstanding. Let me give you a couple of examples. I'll start with a couple from the Old Testament of how understanding the context or how the argument develops and how that might make a difference in understanding the biblical text. The first example I want to take utilize in the Old Testament comes from narrative, and that is the book of Exodus, and particularly Exodus chapter 18, which is the story of Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, visiting him. And Jethro comes to Moses, and he sees Moses as the kind of leader of the Israelite nation. One of his responsibilities is to function as a judge. And so Jethro comes to visit Moses, and he sees him acting as a judge. And Moses is, according to Jethro, Moses is basically wearing himself out and tiring himself out, because he's trying to handle everyone's bringing these cases, large and small, significant and insignificant, to Moses to settle and decide. He's kind of functioning as the judge. And so Jethro sees this and observes this and basically concludes, this really isn't good, Moses. You are wearing yourself out by trying to do too much. You're taking all these cases large and small and settling them, and you can't do this, you can't do it well. So Jethro's solution is you need to delegate the minor cases to other qualified judges, and you just take the big important ones. And so that's what Moses does, and the end of chapter 18 then brings that to a conclusion. Now the question is, why this story in Exodus? There have been a number of suggestions, and this story could be doing a number of things. I don't want to say that what I'm about to say is the only thing it's doing, but one of the more common suggestions from the historical critical approach of just seeing this story in Exodus 18 as describing and explaining the origins of Israelites' judicial system. This is how it came about. So kind of a story telling or describing where the judicial system in Israel's history emerged. At least in more popular literature, a very common explanation is chapter 18 of Exodus tells us, or is an account of the importance of delegating responsibility. So chapter 18 basically instructs Christians that we should not try to do things on our own, and its instruction as to how to delegate authority and delegate responsibility in the business world or in our other endeavors or even in church situations and ministry contexts or organizations. So this is about delegating responsibility, and we find in instructions as to why and how to do that. However, to me, I think the key to understanding this story in chapter 18 is to place it within, again, its broader context, to ask how it relates to what comes before and how it fits into the narrative and the context that has gone on. One thing you'll notice is, again, ignoring chapter and verse divisions, which are can be very important. We said before, chapter and verse divisions are not there to indicate breaks or sections. They're basically there just to help us all get to the right place in a text. So ignoring chapter 18, what is interesting is chapter 18, the story of Moses and Jethro, and Moses getting worn out by all these cases, and Jethro having to tell him, don't do that, give the lesser cases to someone else and take the main ones for yourself. This comes on right after, on the tail end of a story that recounts Israel's battle with the Amalekites in the end of chapter 17. And if you remember, that story is interesting too, because Israel engages in a rather interesting military strategy. Moses is standing up on the mountain and watching this battle, and as long as he keeps his arms up, his hands up in the air, Israel wins. But you have this interesting language of Moses is tired out. He gets worn out and tired, and when his arms drop, Israel starts to lose. When he gets them back up, they win, but he can't hold them up. And so he has to have two individuals basically prop his arms up and hold them up so that Israel is victorious over the Amalekites. Now, this is kind of interesting. You actually have these two stories then where Moses is portrayed as very human and very weak. He can't handle the cases, all the judicial cases in chapter 18. They're wearing him out. He can't do it. In chapter 17, the battle of the Amalekites, he can't even hold his hands out. It wears him out, and he has to have someone help him and hold his arms up. So you have this interesting picture of Moses being worn out and tired out and being weak. He can't do it. Interestingly, though, when you place it in even its broader context, later on in chapter 20, Moses is the one that's going to ascend on Mount Sinai and bring the law down in the context of the flashing and the thunder and lightning and et cetera, et cetera. And even before that, if you go back all before that, this comes in as part of the story of Israel that begins with Moses delivering Israel out of Egypt. So he's the one who gathers them and rallies them out of Egypt. He parts the Red Sea by lifting his staff. He provides provision for them. He provides water in the rock, etc., etc., for the Israelites. And so it's interesting that Moses is portrayed in almost supernatural terms throughout throughout the narrative of Exodus, starting with the deliverance of Israel through the Red Sea, through the wilderness, and all the ways that Moses is an instrument of supernatural provision. His staff seems almost to have supernatural qualities to it. But now in chapter 18, as well as this battle of with the Amalekites in chapter 17, Moses is portrayed as this weak person who gets worn out and he can't do it. And the question is, why would the author portray Moses in these terms when he's almost been a superhero? In fact, one commentary observed that. Up until this point, Moses has been portrayed in supernatural terms. Now he's portrayed as a weak as a very human individual, that he can't even hold his arms up so that they win the battle. He can't handle all these cases. It's wearing him out. And how do we understand this story in chapter 18 in light of this broader context? In the next session, I want to return back to this story, and we'll try to answer that question. How does chapter 18 of Exodus, this portrayal of Moses, and portrayed as a very weak human being, how does this function within the broader context of Exodus, and how does that make a difference in the way we read it?